Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. Last week, we started Dr. Atul Gawande's article published in the October 2nd, 2017 New Yorker, titled, Is Healthcare a Right? In it, he interviews many people, those who consider themselves conservative, liberals, and in between, and manages to find some common ground that points to a way forward in what has become a very polarized issue. In the first half of the article, he speaks with conservatives from his hometown of Athens, Ohio, in the Appalachian foothills. Through stories of their own lives, and specifically their own experiences needing health care, he paints a picture of hardworking individuals who do not like the idea of government becoming involved in the financing of health care. Their beliefs center around the concern that one person's right to health care becomes another person's burden to pay for it. And when some people don't put in and pull their weight, they do not want to be stuck with the bill for them. Some people agree with Medicare for all after 65, because we all pay into it when we earn an income, but most did not like to pay for others' Medicaid. They saw too many abuses by people who they felt could work. Others he spoke with believed that healthcare, like water, is a necessity, not a luxury. These people are hoping the government will step in to fix the system. Dr. Gawande spoke with a man who lives a very independent life, able to fix most things, including his cars, who lives by choice paycheck to paycheck. Arnold gives one of my favorite quotes from the article. He said, I'm lucky I can get my teeth looked at because I'm dating a dental hygienist, but I can't date a dental hygienist and a cardiologist. We are going to start back in the article with Arnold. We read this section last week, but we have time, and it helps set up the rest of the piece. Arnold, with his code of self-reliance, had eliminated nearly all sources of insecurity from his life. But here was one that was way beyond his control. The biggest worry I would have would be some sort of healthcare need, he said. A serious medical issue would cost him his income. As an independent contractor, he isn't eligible for unemployment benefits, and having passed the age of 50, he was just waiting for some health problem to happen. So, did he feel that he had a right to health care? No, I never thought about it as a matter of rights, he said. A lot of these things we think are rights, we actually end up paying for. He thinks that the left typically plays down the reality of the costs, which drives him crazy. But the right typically plays down the reality of the needs, which drives him crazy too. In his view, everyone has certain needs that neither self-reliance nor the free market can meet. He can fix his house, but he needs the help of others if it catches fire. He can keep his car running, but he needs the help of others to pave and maintain the roads. And whatever he does to look after himself, he will eventually need the help of others for his medical care. I think the goal should be security, he said of health care. Not just financial security, but mental security. Knowing that no matter how bad things get, this shouldn't be what you worry about. We don't worry about the fire department or the police. We don't worry about the roads we travel on. And it's not like, here's the traffic lane for the ones who did well and saved money, and you poor people, you have to drive over there. He went on, somebody I know said to me, if we give everybody health care, it'll be abused. I told her that's a risk we take. The roads are abused. A lot of things are abused. It's part of the deal. He told me about a friend who'd undergone an emergency appendectomy. She panicked when she woke up in the hospital, realizing it would cost her a fortune, he said. Think about that. A lot of people will take a crappy job just to get the health benefits rather than start an entrepreneurial idea. If we're talking about tax breaks for rich people to create jobs and entrepreneurialism, why not health care to allow regular people to do the same thing? As he saw it, government existed to provide basic services like trash pickup, a sewer system, roadways, police and fire protection, schools, and health care. Do people have a right to trash pickup? It seemed odd to say so and largely irrelevant. The key point was that these necessities can be provided only through collective effort and shared costs. When people get very different deals on these things, the pact breaks down. And that's what has happened with American healthcare. The reason goes back to a seemingly innocuous decision made during the Second World War, when a huge part of the workforce was sent off to fight. To keep labor costs from skyrocketing, the Roosevelt administration imposed a wage freeze. Employers and unions wanted some flexibility in order to attract desired employees, so the administration permitted increases in health insurance benefits and made them tax exempt. It didn't seem a big thing, but ever since, we've been trying to figure out how to cover the vast portion of the country that doesn't have employer-provided health insurance. Low-wage workers, children, retirees, the unemployed, small business owners, the self-employed, and the disabled. We've had to stitch together different rules and systems for each of these categories, and the result is an unholy, expensive mess that leaves millions unprotected. No other country in the world has built its healthcare system this way, and in the era of the gig economy, it's becoming only more problematic. Between 2005 and 2015, according to analysis by the economists Alan Krueger and Lawrence Katz, 94% of net job growth has been in alternative work arrangements. Freelancing, independent contracting, temping, and the like, which typically offer no health benefits. And we've all found ourselves battling over who deserves less and who deserves more. The Berkeley sociologist Arlie Russell Hochschild spent 5 years listening to Tea Party supporters in Louisiana, and in her masterly book, Strangers in Their Own Land, she identifies what she calls the deep story that they lived and felt. Visualize a long line of people snaking up a hill, she says. Just over the hill is the American dream. You are somewhere in the middle of that line, but instead of moving forward, you find that you are falling back. Ahead of you, people are cutting in line. You see immigrants and shirkers among them. It's not hard to imagine how infuriating this could be to some, how it could fuel an America First ideal, aiming to give pride of place to real Americans and demoting those who would undermine that identity. Foreigners, Muslims, Black Lives Matter supporters, feminists, snowflakes. Our political debates seem to focus on what the rules should be for our place in line. Should the most highly educated get to move up to the front, the most talented? Does seniority matter? What about people whose ancestors were cheated and mistreated? The mistake is accepting the line and its dismal conception of life as a zero-sum proposition. It gives up on the more encompassing possibilities of shared belonging, mutual loyalty, and collective gains. America's founders believed these possibilities to be fundamental. They held life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to be unalienable rights possessed equally by all members of their new nation. The terms of membership have had to be rewritten a few times since, sometimes in blood. But the aspiration has endured, even as what we need to fulfill it has changed. When the new country embarked on its experiment in democracy, health care was too primitive to matter to life or liberty. The average citizen was a hardscrabble rural farmer who lived just 40 years. People mainly needed government to ensure physical security and the rule of law. Knowledge and technology, however, expanded the prospects of life and liberty, and, accordingly, the requirements of government. During the next two centuries, we relied on government to establish a system of compulsory public education, infrastructure for everything from running water to the electric grid, and old age pensions, along with tax systems to pay for it all. As in other countries, these programs were designed to be universal. For the most part, we didn't divide families between those who qualified and those who didn't, between participants and patrons. This inclusiveness is likely a major reason that these policies have garnered such enduring support. Healthcare has been the cavernous exception. Medical discoveries have enabled the average American to live 80 years or longer, and with a higher quality of life than ever before. Achieving this requires access not only to emergency care, but also crucially to routine care and medicines, which is how we stave off and manage the series of chronic health issues that accumulate with long life. We get high blood pressure and hepatitis, diabetes and depression, cholesterol problems and colon cancer. Those who can't afford the requisite care get sicker and die sooner. Yet, in a country where pretty much everyone has trash pickup and K through 12 schooling for the kids, we've been reluctant to address our Second World War mistake and establish a basic system of health care coverage that's open to all. Some even argue that such a system is un-American, stepping beyond the powers the founders envisioned for our government. In fact, in a largely forgotten episode in American history, Thomas Jefferson found himself confronting this very matter shortly after his inauguration as our third president in 1801. Edward Jenner in England had recently developed a smallpox vaccine, a momentous medical breakthrough. Investigating the lore that milkmaids never got smallpox, he discovered that material from scabs produced by cowpox, a similar condition that afflicts cattle, induced a mild illness in people that left them immune to smallpox. Smallpox epidemics came with a mortality rate of 30% or higher and wiped out upward of 5% of the population of cities like Boston and New York. Jefferson read Jenner's report and arranged for the vaccination of 200 relatives, neighbors, and slaves at Monticello. The president soon became vaccination's preeminent American champion. But supplies were difficult to produce, and the market price was beyond the means of most families. Jefferson, along with his successor James Madison, believed in a limited role for the federal government. They did not take expanding its power and its commitments lightly. By the time Jefferson finished his two terms as president, however, city and state governments had almost entirely failed to establish programs to provide vaccines for their citizens. Thousands of lives continued to be lost to smallpox outbreaks. Meanwhile, vaccination programs in England, France, and Denmark had dramatically curbed the disease and measurably raised the national life expectancy. So, at Jefferson's prompting, and with Madison's unhesitating support, Congress passed the Vaccine Act of 1813 with virtually no opposition. A national vaccine agent was appointed to maintain stocks of vaccine and supply it to any American who requested it. The government was soon providing free vaccine for tens of thousands of people each year. It was the country's first healthcare entitlement for the general population, and its passage wasn't in the least controversial. Two centuries later, the Affordable Care Act was passed to serve a similar purpose, to provide all Americans with access to the life-preserving breakthroughs of our own generation. The law narrowed the yawning disparities in access to care, levied the taxes needed to pay for it, and measurably improved the health of tens of millions. But to win passage, the ACA postponed reckoning with our generation's old error of yoking healthcare to our jobs, an error that has made it disastrously difficult to discipline costs and ensure quality, while severing care from our foundational agreement that when it comes to the most basic needs and burdens of life and liberty, all lives have equal worth. The prospects and costs for healthcare in America still vary wildly and incomprehensibly according to your job, your state, your age, your income, your marital status, your gender, and your medical history, not to mention your ability to read fine print. Few want the system we have, but many fear losing what we've got, and we disagree profoundly about where we want to go. Do we want a single nationwide payer of care, Medicare for all? Each state to have its own payer of care, Medicaid for all? A nationwide marketplace where we all choose among a selection of health plans, healthcare.gov for all? Or personal accounts that we can use to pay directly for health care, health savings accounts for all? Any of these can work. Each has been made to work universally somewhere in the world. They all have their supporters and their opponents. We disagree about which benefits should be covered, how generous the financial protection should be, and how we should pay for it. We disagree as well about the trade-offs we will accept. For instance, between increasing simplicity and increasing choice, or between advancing innovation and reducing costs. What we agree on broadly is that the rules should apply to everyone, but we've yet to put this moral principle into practice. The challenge for any plan is to avoid the political perils of a big overnight switch that could leave many people with higher costs and lower benefits. There are, however, many options for a gradual transition. Just this June, the Nevada legislature passed a bill that would have allowed residents to buy into the state's Medicaid plan. if the governor hadn't vetoed it. A similar bill to allow people to buy into Medicare was recently introduced in Congress. We need to push such options forward. Maintaining the link between health coverage and jobs is growing increasingly difficult, expensive, and self-defeating. But deciding to build on what's currently working requires overcoming a well of mistrust about whether such investments will really serve a shared benefit. My friend Betsy Anderson, who taught 8th grade English at Athens Middle School for 15 years, told me something that made me see how deep that well is. When she first started out as a teacher, she said her most satisfying experiences came from working with eager, talented kids who were hungry for her help in preparing them for a path to college and success. But she soon realized that her class, like America as a whole, would see fewer than half of its students earn a bachelor's degree. Her job was therefore to try to help all of her students reach their potential, to contribute in their own way, and to pursue happiness on their own terms. But, she said, by 8th grade, profound divisions had already been cemented. The honors kids, the Hillary Clintons and Mitt Romneys of the school, sat at the top of the meritocratic heap, getting attention and encouragement. The kids with the greatest needs had special education support. But across America, the large mass of kids in the middle, the ones without money, book smarts, or athletic prowess, were outsiders in their own schools. Few others cared about what they felt or believed or experienced. They were the unspecial and unpromising, looked down upon by and almost completely separated from the college-bound crowd. Life was already understood to be a game of winners and losers. They were the designated losers, and they resented it. The most consistent message these students had received was that their lives were of less value than others. Is it so surprising that some of them find satisfaction in a politics that says, essentially, screw them all? I met with Mark, a friend of Arnold's, at the Union Street Diner uptown near the campus of Ohio University, which makes Athens its home. The diner was a low-key place that stayed open 24 hours with formica tables and plastic cups and a late-night clientele that was a mixture of townies and drunken students. I ordered a cheeseburger and onion rings. Mark ordered something healthier. He asked me not to use his last name. The son of a state highway patrolman, he'd graduated from Athens High School 5 years ahead of me. Afterward, he worked as a cable installer and got married at 23. His wife worked at the Super Duper grocery store. Their pay was meager and they were at the mercy of their bosses. So the next year, they decided to buy a convenience store on the edge of town. Mark's father-in-law was a builder, and he helped them secure a bank loan. They manned the register day and night and figured out how to make a decent living. It was never a lot of money, but over time they built up the business, opening gas pumps and hiring college students to work the counter part-time. They were able to make a life of it. They adopted a child, a boy who is now a 25-year-old graduate of the local university. Mark turned 57, and remained a lifelong conservative. In general, he didn't trust politicians, but he felt that Democrats in particular didn't seem to recognize when they were pushing taxes and regulations too far. Healthcare reform was a prime example. It's just the whole time they were coming up with this idea from copying some European model, he said. And I'm going, oh shit, this is not going to end up good for Mark. Yes, he sometimes talks about himself in the third person. For his health coverage, Mark trusted his insurance agent, whom he'd known for decades, more than he trusted the government. He'd always chosen the minimum necessary, a bare-bones, high-deductible plan. He and his wife weren't able to conceive, so they didn't have to buy maternity or contraceptive coverage. With Obamacare, though, he felt forced to pay extra to help others get benefits that he'd never had or needed. I thought, well, here we go. I guess I'm now kicking in for Bill Gates' daughter's pregnancy, too. He wanted to keep government small and taxes low. He was opposed to Obamacare. Then, one morning a year ago, Mark's back started to hurt. It was a work day. I grabbed a Tylenol and I go, no, this isn't going to work. The pain's too weird. It got worse, and when the pain began to affect his breathing, he asked his wife to drive him to the emergency room. They put me in a bed, and 8 minutes later, I'm out, he recalled. I'm dying. someone started chest compressions. A defibrillator was wheeled in, and his heart was given a series of shocks. When he woke up, he learned that he'd suffered cardiac arrest. They said, "Well, you're going to Riverside, a larger hospital in Columbus, 80 miles away." And I went back out again. He'd had a second cardiac arrest, but doctors were able to shock him back to life once more. An electrocardiogram showed him that he'd had a massive heart attack. If he was going to survive, he needed to get to Columbus immediately for emergency cardiac catheterization. The hospital got him a life flight helicopter, but high winds made it unsafe to fly. So they took him by ground as fast as an ambulance could go. On the procedure table, a cardiologist found a blockage in the left main artery to his heart, a widowmaker, doctors call it, and stented it open. "The medicine is just crazy good," Mark said. "By 12:30, I was fixed." After that, he needed 5 days in the hospital and several weeks at home to recover. Although he had to take a pile of drugs to reduce the chance of a recurrence, he got his strength back. He was able to resume work, hang out with his buddies, live his life. It was only after this experience that Mark realized what the ACA had given him. Like 27% of adults under 65, he now had a pre-existing condition that would have made him uninsurable on the individual market before health care reform went into effect. But the ACA requires insurers to accept everyone regardless of health history and to charge the healthy and the less healthy the same community rate. "This would have been a bad story for Mark," he said, "because the same time you're being life-flighted is the same time you lose value to an employer. Your income is done." He no longer opposed the requirement that people get insurance coverage. Fire insurance wouldn't work if people paid for it only when their house was on fire, and health insurance wouldn't work if people bought it only when they needed it. He was no longer interested in repealing protections for people like him. In this, he was like a lot of others. In 2013, before the implementation of the ACA, Americans were asked whether it was the government's responsibility to make sure that everyone had health care coverage, and 56% said no. 4 years after implementation, 60% said yes. "But that doesn't mean I have to sign on for full-blown socialism, cradle to grave, everything," Mark said. "It's a balance. Our willingness to trust in efforts like health reform can be built on experience, as happened with Mark, though we must recognize how tenuous that trust remains. Two sets of values are in tension. We want to reward work, ingenuity, self-reliance, and we want to protect the weak and the vulnerable, not least because over time we all become the weak and vulnerable, unable to get by without the help of others. Finding the balance is not a matter of achieving policy perfection. Whatever program we devise, some people will put in more and some will take out more. Progress ultimately depends on whether we can build and sustain the belief that collective action genuinely results in collective benefit. No policy will be possible otherwise." 8 years after the passage of the Vaccine Act of 1813, a terrible mistake occurred. The agent accidentally sent to North Carolina samples containing smallpox instead of cowpox, causing an outbreak around the town of Tarboro that in the next few months claimed 10 lives. The outrage over the Tarboro tragedy spurred Congress to repeal the program rather than to repair it, despite its considerable success. As a consequence, the United States probably lost hundreds of thousands of lives to a disease that several European programs had made vanishingly rare. It was 80 years before Congress acted again to ensure safe, effective supplies of smallpox vaccine. When I told this story to people in Athens, everyone took the repeal to be a clear mistake, but some could understand how such things happen. One conservative thought that the people in North Carolina might wonder whether the reports of lives saved by the vaccine were fake news. They saw the lives lost from the supposed accident. They knew the victims' names. As for the lives supposedly saved because of outbreaks that didn't occur, if you don't trust the government's vaccines, you don't necessarily trust the government's statistics either. These days, trust in our major professions, in politicians, journalists, business leaders, is at a low ebb. Members of the medical profession are an exception. they still command relatively high levels of trust, it does not seem a coincidence that medical centers are commonly the most culturally, politically, economically, and racially diverse institutions you will find in a community. These are places devoted to making sure that all lives have equal worth, but they also pride themselves on having some of the hardest working, best trained, and most innovative people in society. This isn't to say that doctors, nurses, and others in healthcare fully live up to the values they profess. We can be condescending and heedless of the costs we impose on patients' lives and bank accounts. We still often fail in our commitment to treating equally everyone who comes through our doors. But we're embarrassed by this. We're expected to do better every day. The repeal of the Vaccine Act of 1813 represented a basic failure of government to deliver on its duty to protect the life and liberty of all. But the fact that public vaccination programs eventually became ubiquitous, even if it took generations, might tell us something about the ultimate direction of our history, the direction in which we are still slowly, fitfully creeping. On Mark's last day in the hospital, the whole team came in to see him. He thanked them. "But I didn't thank them for taking care of me," he said. "I thanked them for when I was smoking, drinking, and eating chicken wings. They were all here working and studying, and I appreciated it." "That's what you thanked them for?" "Yeah," he said, "because if Mark wasn't going to stop this, they were going to have to keep working hard. Something had to happen because Mark was clogging up. And those people did keep working hard. They were there getting ready for Mark regardless of who he would turn out to be, rich or poor, spendthrift or provident, wise or foolish," I said. "I am glad they do this every day, but I'm hoping to do it only once." Thank you for tuning in to Sound Body today. Stay well, and please come back next week for more healthy living ideas. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig. And I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.